with film crews and correspondents tumbling out and nearly just as quickly tumbling back in, having been turned away by the ever-vigilant jail attendant and bikini inspector. John sips from the now warm Lipton tea. The guy was doing a pretty good job. A white Dodge Ram pickup truck comes down the road, turns into the lot, stopping next to the red Dodge Colt. A tall, thin woman gets out, wearing the same type of uniform as the male attendant, and she sprints to the rear door of the jail. John checks the time. It's 5:10 in the afternoon. He's thinking someone's late, and there goes the bikini inspector into his Colt, and his tires squeal as he gets out onto the main street, back into whatever Sunday afternoon life awaits him. John dips into his soft leather briefcase and pulls out a necktie, which he quickly secures around his neck. Now it's time to get to work. It feels good to walk across to the jail, stretching his legs, and he goes up to the familiar door with the sign and rings the doorbell, and rings it once more. A shadow appears, as before, but it's the woman attendant now, red hair tousled, face flushed and perspiring, and she says, "How can I?" He grabs the door, opens it wider. "Sorry I'm late," he says. "I'm here to see Specialist Tyler." "Hey, what?" He pushes past her and says, "Is he ready? I won't take long." The woman steps in front of him. "Hold on, just who the hell are you?" John lets her stand for a few seconds and then shapes his face into surprised anger. "You don't know?" "Honestly?" "Before he went hunting today, Chief Kane told me it was going to be all arranged. Hold on." He grabs his regular wallet, takes out his Virginia driver's license, flashes it in front of the poor young woman and says, "I'm Dr. John Huang of the U.S. Army Medical Corps. I flew in a while ago from Washington, D.C. I'm here to personally interview the four rangers, starting with Specialist Tyler." The woman bites her lower lip. John chose Tyler for a reason, for according to the briefing he received last night at the motel, Tyler is the youngest of the four. "Why are you here?" she asks. "Ma'am, that's medical information, and that's confidential," he says, putting an edge into his voice. "Now, will you bring Specialist Tyler to me, or are we going to have to wait here until Chief Kane returns from Sweeney's tract and have him order you directly, and then have another conversation with you later?" "Ma'am?" Her shoulders slump.
"Hold on."
"Don't mind if I do," John says. 10 minutes later, he's in a small meeting room with one-way glass built into the wall, a table bolted to the floor, and two black plastic chairs. He's sitting in one chair, and Specialist Vinnie Tyler is sitting in the other, wearing an orange jumpsuit that says Ralston PD Jail in faded black letters on the back. John is smiling and gracious with the young man, who's got a lot of muscles and strength under that jail clothing. His red hair is trimmed short, and there's stubble on his chin and cheeks. His eyes look green. His face is pale, but he constantly looks around the room with suspicion, like he's waiting for a net to drop from the ceiling or for the sprinklers to start spraying out water. John says, "Specialist, I'm Lieutenant John Huang, a psychiatrist with the Army's Medical Corps. How are you doing? How's the food? Are the staff treating you well?" His eyes continue to flick around the room.
"Doing okay. Food sucks, but I've eaten worse. And the staff seems to be just one guy or gal, so that's about it."
"Why are you here?" "Here to talk to you."
"About what?"
John shrugs, leans back in his chair, and relaxes his legs and arms in an open position, wanting the ranger before him to see John not as a threat, but as a possible ally or even friend. "About whatever you like," he says. "Where you grew up, why you joined the army, why you became a ranger. I've seen the training courses you guys have to go through. Incredibly difficult, aren't they?" The specialist doesn't take the bait. His eyes have stopped flickering. They're boring right into John. He continues, "Or you can talk about your deployments, the missions you were on, what you saw, what you did." Tyler moves his wrists like he still can't believe he's manacled.
"Or why me and the team got arrested for what happened over in Sullivan?"
The ranger calmly says, like he's reading out a map grid of numbers and letters.
"You want me to talk about that?"
Defiance, John thinks. He's talking, but there's will and defiance there. "If you'd like," he says.
"Sure,"
he says.
"Then you'd use it against me." right?
Not exactly, he says. But I need to inform you, specialist, that I'm here as a psychiatrist attached to a special investigative CID unit. I'm not here to represent you as a patient.
Meaning what?
Meaning that what I learn in talking with you will be part of the CID's investigation into what might have happened that led to your arrest.
A cop?
No, Huang says. A doctor who's looking for truth.
To use against me?
To be used in seeking justice, Huang says. To find out who you are, what you're thinking, to see if there are any extenuating circumstances. To make this CID investigation fair and complete, you have my word. The young man's eyes continue to drill into him. John doesn't yet know the specifics of his service, but he knows from experience the outline of what this hard young man has done. Rangers are the proverbial tip of the spear. They go in hard and fast and get the job done. They are sent into the hottest and most dangerous places, and even though in another life Specialist Tyler could have been an automotive technician or a home contractor, John is under no illusions. This young man before him has killed in the service of his country and has seen friends of his wounded, maimed, and killed right beside him.
Your word,
Tyler says, dragging the two words out.
You think I'd trust the word of a pogue?
Pogue, John recalls. Person other than a grunt. I would hope so.
What do you know about me, about what I do?
He starts demanding.
You ever go overseas? You ever been in a pit in a forward base, hearing the mortars whistle in? You ever shove wads of combat gauze into a buddy who's bleeding out? You ever been up against some sandbags and all of a sudden sand pours down on your head and you hear the gunshot from the sniper who almost drilled one into your forehead?
John says, I don't think that really... Tyler quickly changes subject.
You a virgin, Doc?
That's something I'm not here to talk about, he says. A jingle jangle of the handcuffs as Tyler moves his hands.
Oh yeah, it is. You know what I mean. There's a whole lot of difference between reading about having great sex with a hot chick and actually doing it. No books, no magazines, no porn videos, nothing is like the real deal. That's the difference between you and me, although we're both army, you just don't know what it's like out in combat.
John has heard this before and he says, then why did you agree to talk to me? Tyler struggles, sits back in the chair, blinks his eyes, looks down at the dirty tile floor and then looks up again.
Sometimes the guilt just gets so hot and raw you need to talk to someone other than your team buddies,
Tyler says, his voice softer.
When things don't go right, when innocents pop up.
His voice softly dribbles away to heavy silence.
Please, tell me more,
John says, putting as much sympathy and empathy as he can into his voice.
We've made progress. We're opening him up. This is going to work.
He's looking forward to reporting back to Major Cook what he's about to find out.
Please, John repeats. Talk to me.
Tyler gets up, chair scraping, cuffed hands before him.
No, he says. I've changed my mind.
Chapter 18. Time passes slowly, but Staff Sergeant Caleb Jefferson is in no rush. Earlier, when Specialist Tyler unexpectedly left, he whispered quick orders to Barnes and Ruiz, the other members of his fire team, about what to do next, and like the good men they are, they followed his orders. A door opens up with a metallic clunk, and the woman jail attendant, Marcy, brings Ruiz in, putting him back into his cell, and Jefferson stands up. Marcy comes to the old-fashioned barrel cell door and says,
Your turn, Sergeant Jefferson, if you wish.
Yes, ma'am.
You promised to be a gentleman like before?
Absolutely, ma'am.
You know what's next?
I do, ma'am.
He puts his hands through a slot in the bars so Marcy can handcuff them, and after the shackles snap into place, he steps back as she uses a large metal key on a wooden stick to unlock the door. With the cell door open, she gestures him forward and he follows her direction. She and the other jailers seem in awe of him and his team, which is just fine because they are widely ignorant of what he and they are capable of. Jefferson thinks that in under a minute he could hurt and disable Marcy, free himself, Barnes, Tyler, and Ruiz, and get out of this small town in under 10 minutes, never to be seen again. It's certainly something to think about.
In the small interrogation room, he stares at the army psychiatrist as he pulls his chair up close to the small table and lets his handcuffed hands and thick arms stretch across the tabletop, invading Dr. John Huang's personal space. Jefferson knows a lot about shooting people, leading men, and blowing things up, but he also knows a bit of how an officer's mind works. Huang is slim, well-dressed, and of Chinese descent. To Jefferson, this means he's come from the kind of strict Asian upbringing in which mom and dad forced their children to be 100% at all times. Tiger moms and tiger dads. He, on the other hand, grew up in Gilmore Homes in Baltimore, living with his grandmother, mom in jail and dad gone, and the street education he got there was probably one hell of a lot rougher and to the point than what the good doctor experienced.
So, Jefferson says, what do you want?
Huang is leaning back in his chair, trying to look cool and inviting, and Jefferson will have none of that. His brown eyes are tight and intelligent, and the staff sergeant is going to be cautious with this bright man, even if he's probably never picked up a weapon since basic.
You came to see me, the doctor says. Why is that?
Jefferson says,
you came here and specifically asked for Specialist Tyler. That's why I'm in this room with you. To see what you did to him. He's the youngest member of my team. You trying to tempt him? Break him?
The doctor says, I just wanted to talk to him.
How did it go?
It went fine.
Jefferson smiles.
How did the other two interviews go? Not as well?
They went fine. The doctor repeats. Jefferson slightly shakes his head.
Oh, come on, Doc. It didn't go well, so don't bullshit me. I've got one hell of a good bullshit detector built and polished over the years, working with upstanding officers like you. Don't tell me otherwise.
He says, fair enough. I won't bullshit you. And I'll say the other two men, Barnes and Ruiz, were quiet and formidable. They barely went beyond name and rank and said you were the best staff sergeant they've ever served with.
Not surprised, Jefferson says. They're the best I've ever led. Now, back to the original question. What do you want?
To talk to you and your men, Huang says. You've been arrested. All four of you are facing serious charges.
That's like telling me the sun just set, Jefferson says. You've got to do better than that.
Huang tries to maintain his composure, but Jefferson knows he's getting under the doctor's skin. Jefferson says,
you want to talk to me? Fine. I'll save us all a bunch of time and tell you what's what.
Huang says, all right. I'm curious to hear what you have to say. Jefferson makes a point of leaning over a bit more.
Just a question before I begin. You ever been out in the field?
I don't see how.
Lieutenant, I get an answer or I'm out of here.
Huang doesn't look happy. No, he says.
All right, let's put it out there. My men and I, we don't fight for God, country, or whatever clown is sitting in the Oval Office. We fight for one another, or our platoon, or our battalion. That is it. When you're in a trench in the middle of the night and the Mooj are coming through the wire sending RPG rounds your way, you may hate the guy next to you for stealing your clean socks last week, but by God, you've got his back.
Huang sits quietly and Jefferson says,
and who's got our back?
The Army, JAG, CID, you, anybody else?
The doctor says,
I can help you. You tell me what's going on, what happened. I might be able to
help in what way?
Jefferson asks,
are you going to get that county sheriff to set us free? Think the district attorney won't indict us? You think the families of those folks in that old historical house are going to forget what happened? You going to tell CID that it was all a mistake and put pressure on the county sheriff to let us go?
Huang snaps too. You're telling me that you and your squad were in that house, Staff Sergeant? Jefferson withdraws his hands, puts them in his lap. That was stupid, getting angry like that.
That's enough, Jefferson says. Enough.
Huang slowly unfolds himself from his chair and leans over the table.
Tell me, Sergeant. Tell me what happened in that home. Why were you there?
Did they shoot first? Did you respond automatically, not able to stop?
Jefferson says, you like being a doctor.
What? Huang asks, confused. Yes, I do.
Jefferson slowly stands up. I love docs, honest to God, I do. Combat medics in the field, shit, they are the goddamn best. Mortar rounds exploding around you, grenades flying overhead, rounds whipping near you. You hunker down so hard you want to dig a hole 8 meters deep with your hands. But when a guy gets a piece of shrapnel in his neck, when somebody screams out, I'm hit, medic, those guys jump up and run out and do their job. God, I love them and respect them.
He turns, anger building in him.
But not you, Lieutenant. You're a goddamn head doc, worthless. And if you come talk to my squad again without my permission, one of these days I'll track you down and hurt you. Bad.
Chapter 19. Special Agent Manuel Sanchez pulls over to the side of the road in his rented Ford sedan, yawns, rubs at his eyes. It's been one long, grueling day, for after his interview with Wendy Gabriel, he decided to continue going up and down Route 119, interviewing other households that might have witnesses to what happened on Wednesday night. Not surprisingly, the interviews went bust. He's talked to 2 men, 3 women, and 2 young boys in a variety of rural houses and mobile homes, up and down this lonely stretch of Georgia State Highway, and no one saw a thing. Lunch was a bottle of orange Fanta and 2 packages of peanuts from a service station's vending machine just outside Sullivan. He checks the car's clock. It's just after 8 p.m., the time when Wendy said she saw the pickup truck owned by Staff Sergeant Jefferson leave the Kill House 4 nights ago. The dirt driveway to the summer house and a utility pole with a single street light are up ahead. Time to see what Wendy claims she saw. He puts the car in drive, goes to the driveway, and backs in a couple of meters. Sanchez leaves the engine in park, gets out, and walks in the glare of the headlights out to the road. He turns around, looks at the Ford sedan. Even with the glare of the headlights, it's easy to make out the license plate. He goes back to the car, flicks off the headlights, leaving the amber parking lights on. There, still visible. He stands on the road, looks up at the streetlight. It's an old streetlight, the kind with a large bulb screwed into a metal dome. The light is yellow and weak, gradually fading in and out. Interesting. He looks around at the scenery. So dark, so empty. Just brooding, heavy trees. The bare pavement. So quiet save for insects out there and night birds and a dog barking. Toby, maybe? Maybe. So very, very different from the constant lights, noise, horns, engines, and music back home in L.A. Sanchez goes back to the car, switches off even the parking lights, and then returns to the road. The overhead utility light is still bright enough to make out the license plate. Not crystal clear, but enough to do the job, for someone to get the first 3 letters and a number. There you go, he whispers. His jacket feels clammy and confining on him, so he takes it off, folds it in half, and then stops. A car or truck engine out there. He turns. No headlights. He looks back at the sedan. Walks to it, opens the door, drapes the jacket, a Brooks Brothers coat with shiny buttons his wife Conchita bought for him when he got a promotion last year, over the driver's seat so the buttons are facing up. He switches on the headlights. Goes back to the road. The license plate is clear, the color of the car is easy to make out, as well as the car brand. That's it. He returns to the car, switches off the headlights, puts on the parking lights once more. Goes back to the road. Waits. The overhead utility light fades in and out, the yellow light faint. An engine loudly starts up and his LAPD instincts kick in as he leaps away from the road, just as a pickup truck roars by, so close he feels the warmth from the exhaust pipe. The truck races down the road and brakes, squealing rubber. The truck's lights are doused. It waits somewhere down the road. Sanchez's Sig Sauer is in his hands. He doesn't remember pulling it from his holster. He quickly goes to the Ford, switches off the parking lights. He He drops to one knee, holding the pistol in both hands over the hood of his rental car. The truck is still there. Engine running loudly. No lights, no voices, no honky-tonk tunes coming from within. He's pretty sure the driver switched off the engine some ways back and coasted down here before roaring by to catch him by surprise. Sanchez wishes he could trade the rented sedan for one of the unit cars he used back when he was a cop. Then at least he'd have some heavier firepower, a Remington 870 pump-action shotgun or a Bushmaster 223 semi-automatic rifle with a 30-round magazine. The driver revs the engine. Sanchez whispers, "Come on, pendejo. Come on back and let's play." Another squeal of rubber, and the truck roars down the highway. And a few seconds later, its headlights and taillights flick on, like the driver is taunting him. Sanchez stands up, puts the Sig Sauer back in its holster. The overhead streetlight is still weak, and he looks into the car interior and sees not a thing. Chapter 20. Staff Sergeant Caleb Jefferson stares at his late-night visitor and says, "How the hell did you get in here?" Major Frank Moore, executive officer for the 4th Battalion, says, "I spun a tail, what else? I told the jail attendant I really, really needed to see you and she wouldn't let me in, and then I pulled the weary war vet who needs help bullshit story." Jefferson says, "And that got you here?" Moore shakes his head. "Nah, I had to promise to give her a helicopter ride next week." "Sir, you need to leave right now," Jefferson says. "This isn't helping. But you need to know a couple of things, and I sure as hell don't trust the phones here or at the post," Moore says. The major is a good guy and has run interference for him several times with the battalion commander, Lieutenant Colonel Marcello. But Moore is exposing himself, being an hour away from post and at this town jail. "All right, sir, but please make it quick." The major is still in his fatigues and he lowers his voice. "The battalion commander was interviewed earlier today by two CID investigators. I'm sure Marcello told the investigators what fine, upstanding troopers we are." Moore smiles. "I had my ear to the door. He threw all of you under the bus, you know, the heavy-duty one with the spiked tires."
"You drove out here to tell me this?"
Jefferson asks. "Staff Sergeant, I'm an officer, but I try not to be stupid," he says. "The crew that's here looking into things, it's not a typical CID investigation. They're here from Quantico, and they're going to poke into anything and everything."
"I know that," Jefferson says. "My guys and I were interviewed a few hours ago by a shrink trying to find out what makes this tick."
"What did you tell him?" Jefferson says.
"I told the nosy little shit I wet the bed a lot when I was a kid and had mommy issues. What do you think?"
"This isn't a joking matter, Sergeant."
"Again, you drove out here to tell me that, sir?" he asks. "Major Moore, did they talk to you as well?"
"That they did," Moore says. "I told them I hardly knew you and your squad."
"Good job, sir," he says, pleased that this officer at least is on the beam. "Is there anything else?"
"Your Aunt Sophie called me," he says.
"Oh, shit," Jefferson thinks.
"No."
"Yes," Major Moore says.
"Is everything all right with Carol?"
Moore says, "Oh yes, Carol is doing fine under the circumstances. What we talked about earlier is all set, but Aunt Sophie knows you and yours are in trouble and she wants to..."
"No,"
Jefferson says. "Sergeant, all she wants..."
"Sir, no," Jefferson says. "It's all under control. Everything is under control, thanks to you. But if my aunt starts making a fuss, it'll be all done. Game over. You call my aunt on your way home. Tell her to keep quiet, please. Keep quiet."
"Sergeant, are you sure?"
100%, he says, scraping his chair back. "Call my aunt when you can. Tell her I'm fine. Tell her thanks for taking care of my girl, and that I'll come over for a visit when I can. But be careful. Call my aunt from a payphone on your way back."
"Might be hard to find one."
"Sir, no offense. You better find one," he says.
90 minutes later, Major Frank Moore pulls up to his townhouse in Georgetown. His late-night dinner, fried chicken from a Publix store nearby, sitting on the car's passenger seat. Besides a quick meal, this Publix also offered a rear public payphone outside, which he used to call Staff Sergeant Jefferson's Aunt Sophie Johnson. The strong-willed and strong-voiced woman seemed to reluctantly agree to her nephew's request to keep quiet and not stir up a fuss about what was happening to the staff sergeant. Moore gets out of his Honda CRV, goes up the brick pathway to the front door. It's a nice, quiet development, and his wife, Patricia, 4 months along with their first child, is spending the week visiting her mom in D.C. He gets to the door, puts the plastic bag on the steps, and as he takes the key out to unlock the door, hears rustling in the shrubbery over by the living room windows. Damn white-tailed deer, he thinks, are getting more and more brazen, coming out and chewing up everyone's yard. And as he steps back to take a closer look, a man emerges from the shrubbery and says, "Hey, Major Moore." Before Moore can reply, the man pulls a pistol with a sound suppressor from his waistband and shoots the Army Major in the forehead.
Chapter 21. It's early evening and I'm leaning so heavily on my cane that I think the metal might split. My left leg feels like it's a carved roast sizzling under an infrared restaurant lamp. My leg throbs and throbs, seemingly in pace with my heartbeat, and what's keeping me going is knowing that this is our last visit of the day. And when I get back to my motel room, it'll be time for my early evening ration of extra strength Tylenol. Earlier, Connie and I visited the Route 119 Gas and Go convenience store, and an eager young Indian man working behind the counter who didn't speak much English managed to tell us that we needed to speak to his uncle Vihan in the morning to get access to the store's surveillance system. Now we're at the side entrance of Briggs Brothers' funeral home after a bit of sleuthing. All right, maybe 10 seconds work on Connie's part, revealed that the Sullivan County coroner is Ferguson Briggs, owner of the largest funeral home in this part of Georgia. The building is white, with black shutters, with a mini steeple to make it look like a house of worship, and a three-car garage is off to the side of a large paved parking lot. There's a lot of shrubbery and a wooden sign out on the road painted black in a faded maroon color. Without asking for direction from me, her commanding officer, Connie picks up the courtesy phone.
"Hello," she says. "Yes, who's this, please?" "Jim Briggs, thank you. Could you meet me at your door, please? I'm Special Agent Connie York from the U.S. Army, here with Major Jeremiah Cook." "Yes, we're Army investigators and..." "Thank you, we'll wait."
Connie's face is red and shiny with perspiration and strands of her blonde hair are sticking to her forehead, but she still looks great. She catches me looking at her and says,
"What?"
"Been a long day," I say.
"Yeah, and not much progress," she says. "I hope the others have something to show for it."
"When we're done here, send out a group text," I reply. "Time for a session back at the motel before we call it a night." Connie looks over my shoulder at a nearby brick building with a concrete chimney and then the three-car garage and says,
"Think that's where they keep the hearses?"
"Watch your language," I say. "They're called coaches." Inside the funeral home, lights click on.
"Duly noted," Connie says. "Funny thing, the county coroner being a funeral director."
"Lots of funny things here in Sullivan County," I say. "And it's an elected position, meaning the good citizens of this county didn't vote him in just because he's got a degree in forensics or forensic anthropology. He's here because probably he treats the locals with respect, sympathy, and doesn't overcharge them for pretty boxes with shiny handles."
"Aren't you the cynic today?" she says, smiling.
"Sir."
Flying
insects are hammering themselves against two yellow light bulbs when the rear door is unlocked and a young man steps out, straightening his thin black necktie. To Connie, I say, "It's a day ending in Y." "Thank you, sir, for coming to see us, Mr. Briggs. I'm Major Cook, and this is Special Agent York. We're with the Army's Criminal Investigation Division." He's about a half foot taller than me, early 20s, skinny, and he runs one hand through a thick tangle of brown hair while trying to tighten the knot on his necktie with the other. He has on black trousers, black shoes, a white dress shirt that's wrinkled, and I have three quick assumptions. One, he's wearing this clothing on a Sunday evening because his father told him to. Two, like it or not, he's going to inherit this family business one of these days. And three, he's probably not alone back there in the funeral home. He's either with someone else or a video game. I know I wouldn't want to be alone with bodies being stored in the building's basement.
Aw, heck, you can call me Jimmy, he says. But I need to see your IDs. A couple of months ago, some guy from the Georgia State Patrol came by and I was fixing him coffee, and Daddy nearly tore my head off when he came over and found out I didn't know if the guy was official or not.
Connie displays her shield, as do I, and she says, Was he official?
Oh yeah, but that didn't mean anything, he says shyly. Daddy was still upset. What can I do for you folks?
I take a breath as a new, stronger wave of pain radiates up and down my leg. I understand the county coroner's office is located here, am I right? Jimmy nods.
100%. Daddy's been coroner for 12 years, and in less than 2 weeks, he's going to be reelected.
Do you have the bodies of the folks who were murdered this past Wednesday here in storage? I ask. His face seems even more yellow in the light.
Blessed Jesus, that we do. We're lucky the two of the guys were pretty skinny. We were able to put them together on one tray, and the mom and her kid.
He swallows, revealing a prominent Adam's apple.
Bless them all.
We'd like to examine them, please, I say.
Now? You mean right now?
That's right, I say. He shakes his head.
Can't do it, sir, can't.
I say, you've seen our shields. We've identified ourselves. 4 Army Rangers have been arrested for those murders. We'd like your assistance in our investigation. Another shake of the head, and he takes a step back into the funeral home like he'd rather be in a place storing 7 dead civilians than be out here with us.
I can't do that. Honest, I can't, he says. Daddy would have my hide.
I don't have to say anything, but Connie steps into play, smiling.
I appreciate what you're saying, Jimmy, but we're from the Army, trying to do a very hard job, she says, her voice sweet and calming. I know you don't want to disappoint your father. He does seem very strict, but he did leave you in charge, didn't he? And I know this area of the country is very, very patriotic. Don't you want to help us? Support the troops right here by letting us into your business?
I think Connie's on the mark, but Jimmy shakes his head and starts closing the door.
Daddy'll be here tomorrow, after 9 a.m. You can try him then.
The door gets closed and locked, and one by one, the lights here on the first floor switch off. Connie sighs, wipes her face.
Once, boss, I saw this horror movie about a funeral home, where the dead all rise during the night and tear the funeral home owner to pieces. Before they get really nasty, that is.
Sometimes dreams don't come true, I say. Send out the text. Let's get back to the motel. In the car, I sit down with a grimace and buckle up. Connie works her phone a moment before starting up the Ford Fusion, then switching on the air conditioner and headlights. Just as she gets us back on the road, another car up the street pulls out. I grip my cane, occasionally glancing at the side view mirror, as we drive along, taking a turn or two. Connie checks her phone quickly and says,
Done, sir. Everybody is coming back in. Should be ready in about 30 minutes.
Good, I say. Anything else?
Yes, sir, she says. Ever since we left that funeral home, we've been followed. I even made a slight detour, and those headlights never left us.
Good call, Agent York, I say, looking again in the side view mirror. Let's do something about it.
You want me to lose them? She asks.
I painfully shift in my seat, remove my Sig Sauer. No, I say. I want you to stop them.
Chapter 22. Special Agent York has worked long enough with Major Cook to know that when he makes a request like this one, he doesn't want to get a lot of questions in return. Just get the job done. Connie likes working for a supervisor who has confidence in his employees without micromanaging them.
Connie says, Yes, sir, I'm on it. Make sure your seatbelt is nice and tight.
It is, he says, holding the pistol in the door handle. Just don't crash us.
Connie starts accelerating.
What, you don't like my driving?
I don't like filling out motor vehicle accident paperwork, he says. Go.
Connie goes, speeding up even more. The car behind them speeds up as well. The lights from the small businesses and homes flash by as she quickly exceeds the 40-mile-an-hour speed limit and goes right up to 60. which is as much as she dares on this narrow road. A look up to the rearview mirror. Still there. She thinks of saying that maybe those are cops back there, but she keeps her mouth shut. The major certainly isn't afraid or concerned about being pulled over, so why mention it? Focus on the driving. The road sweeps to the left, and there's a squeal of tires as she handles the Ford nice and tight, keeping it in their lane, making sure they don't drift over the solid yellow line. 63. 64. The road is a straightaway now, and the pursuing lights are getting closer, like they're egging her on. She quickly wishes she was back with the Virginia State Police with backup only a radio call away. In a calm voice, Cook says, "Intersection coming up, light's still green." Connie's tempted to slow down with all that civilian traffic crowding up the intersection, but no, she's getting angrier that she and the major are being chased at night, in this rural town in Georgia, like moonshiners being chased by the cops. "Light's turning yellow," Cook says. "No worries," Connie says. They race through the intersection, horns honking and screaming at them, Connie expertly passing a blue van slowing to make the stop. Up ahead, the road swerves hard to the left and she lets her foot off the accelerator, switches off the headlights. Turning hard, Connie pulls into the parking lot of a McDonald's, quickly halting the Ford between a parked pickup truck and a mud-spattered Toyota, using the emergency brake to prevent any brake lights from popping on back there. She turns and sees a black Dodge Charger roar by, and then she slips the Ford out of the parking lot and soon pulls up behind it, keeping the headlights off for a moment. Cook says, "Well done, Connie." Even with the adrenaline rush from this ongoing chase, Connie feels a spark of pleasure from her boss's praise in a tight situation like this. She turns on the headlights, flicks them to high beams, and says in a heavy drawl, "The Virginia State Police aims to serve, sir." No answer, but that's fine. She barrels up right to the rear of the Charger, and she can see movement inside, like the passenger or driver is looking out the rear window, trying to see who's now chasing them. "Sucks to be on the other side," she says. And the major says, "Keep at it, keep hammering them." The Charger makes an abrupt right onto a narrow road, and Connie swears, missing the turnoff. She slams on the brakes, the Ford sedan shivers and comes to a halt, and she slams the shifter into reverse, the transmission grinding a complaint. Cook looks behind and says, "Clear," into drive, down the narrow road. The Charger's lights are off now, but she catches a brief glimpse of it as it passes under a utility light, and she punches the accelerator down. The Ford roars into life as she resumes the chase, everything narrowed and focused into a tube before her, looking at the Dodge speeding away, barely noticing the flick, flick, flick of objects passing by, like trailers and dirt driveways and utility poles. As the road gets emptier, the taillights up ahead come on, and she knows the driver of the Charger is concerned about crashing into something in the dark, sacrificing stealth for safety. The lane gets narrower, no more driveways, no more distant lights. A yellow and black sign is visible for a second, dead end. "Good," Cook says. A thump as the pavement gives way to dirt. "Sir," she says, "I think..." The taillights up ahead drop from sight. Something moves across her field of vision. Connie slams on the brakes, the Ford sedan fishtailing as the tires try to grip the dirt and gravel road, and for the briefest of moments, a chest-high white metal pipe blocking the road snaps into view, and Connie closes her eyes as the car hits it hard. Chapter 23. In the last few seconds of our chase, I try to focus on Connie's superb driving skills as we force the Dodge Charger into a dead-end lane, but my mind is racing back to last year, and the voices come to me. "Move, move, move! Faster! We're taking fire!" Connie slams on the brakes, the Ford skids. Then a loud, bone-shattering thud and metal scraping and screaming and... not there. Here. We've hit a metal pole set across the dirt road and my chest hurts from slamming against the shoulder harness. My cane is on the floor, but my hand is still holding my Sig Sauer. Dust clouds settle in front of us. The hood of the sedan is scraped and dented, the heavy white metal pole just a few inches away from the windshield. Any faster or lower, the pole would have shattered the windshield and taken off our respective heads. I hold the Sig Sauer with both hands so Connie can't see the shaking. but my left leg, still quietly howling in pain, starts a series of tremors. You all right, Connie?
Sir, yes, sorry, are you okay?
Fire, I think. Slight chance, but what if that collision tore something in the fuel line and there's a spark? We're trapped here and Connie can easily get out, but I take a breath. Can you back us out? She shifts the car into reverse, backs us out. Metal groaning and moaning. The headlights pick up a large dip in the road, explaining why the taillights from the speeding car ahead of us had seemingly disappeared. Trees and brush are close by, and I see the bent metal pole set across the dirt lane. At one end is a chain lock, and on the other side is a large bolt mechanism, allowing it to be raised and lowered at will. I take another breath, squeeze my hands tighter around the comforting grip of the pistol. This is how it happened, I say. One of the guys in the Charger calls a friend. We're being chased. The friend says, go down this road, get a bit of a lead, and I'll take care of it. The Charger races past the open gate. Their friend drops the gate almost in time to take our heads off. Just like in the stand. Villagers and the Taliban out there keeping watch, talking on cell phones, ready to hit us when they're good and ready. Connie rubs her face with both hands.
Seems like a good explanation, sir.
My heart rate is calming down. I look around at the darkness about us, imagine men hidden there, watching us, considering us, armed and waiting. At least we're not on fire. Ask you a question, Connie?
Certainly, sir.
Your first marriage to George, why did it end? She says not a word, which I expected. Chapter 24. Connie turns and stares at Major Cook. After this chase and the collision and nearly having both of their heads torn off, why in God's name is he asking her about her first failed marriage? What the hell is going on? Cook is quiet, but Connie gives him a good look, sees his cane on the floor, his left injured leg shaking, his hands gripping his Sig Sauer, and his eyes looking straight out there into the darkness. Now she knows. He's not all here. Part of him is back in Afghanistan. Asking her about her first failed marriage, something safe, something domestic to talk about after this violent chase reminded him of a war zone. He's trying to get back here, all of him.
Boxes, sir,
she says, noticing the Ford's engine is running rough. Go on.
After we moved in together, he had about 20 cardboard boxes filled with books, clothing, all that stuff, she says. And when he got it all unpacked, he kept the empty boxes in the basement, all neatly piled up. Month after month, I begged him to get rid of the boxes. They were taking up so much space. And when he didn't do that,
her boss says, you knew that deep down, where it counted, he wasn't committed to the marriage. And Walter, what was his deal? She tightens her grip on the steering wheel, lifts herself up a bit from the seat, peers ahead. The dust has settled and there's nothing more to be seen. Connie says,
Walter was one for setting traps. Like cleaning out the dishwasher, folding the laundry, getting the oil changed in the car, all without me asking. And those were his traps. Connie, didn't you see what I did? Why don't I get credit? Why don't you notice me? And I told him, Walter, you're so big into ambushes, why the hell don't you transfer from CID to an infantry unit?
Did he?
No, she says. Left the CID and joined the FBI. Last I heard, he was in Des Moines, chasing down farmers cheating on their government subsidies.
The engine is running even rougher. Cook reaches down, picks up his cane, and sets it across his lap. Connie says,
sorry about the accident. I'll do the paperwork.
No, her boss says. My job, I'll take care of it. But you can turn us around and head us back to the motel. We've still got lots of work to do. Connie shifts the car into reverse again, and after a bit of careful three-point turning, she heads back up the road.
I'm also sorry I lost them, she says.
Nothing to apologize for. The Ford bumps some as they get back onto asphalt.
Sir? She asks. I don't understand.
Cook puts his Sig Sauer back into his holster. I wanted whoever's out there to know we're aware of them following us, and that we're going to do something about it.
You did well, Connie. No worries. But do get us back to the motel without hitting anything else. Connie smiles.
Can do, sir.
They drive on for a few more minutes, and she looks up in the rearview mirror, makes a quick turn, and then looks again.
Major?
We're being followed again, he says.
That's right.
Let them follow us, he says, the Sig Sauer coming back out into his hand. But if they come too close or try to do anything funny, throw us into a U-turn.
And then try to shake them off?
No, Cook says, lowering his window with one hand, pistol firm in the other. I have other ideas.
Chapter 25.
The drive goes smoothly after that, with the not-so-friendly lights still behind us, and as we near our destination, I roll the window up. When Connie gets us back to the Route 119 motel and coffee shop, there's a huddled group of men and women outside our room 11. Connie parks our damaged Ford as close as she can, and she says,
Sorry, boss, the Fourth Estate has arrived, in all their assumed glory.
Damn it, I think, because I wanted to get to my room first to secure some painkillers, but I'm not in the mood to maneuver my way twice through that enthusiastic mob. No pain relief anytime soon. As before, Connie, I say, grabbing my cane, I'll take the lead. She unsnaps her seatbelt.
You'll take the lead in answering questions, sir. I'll take the lead in blocking us a path.
The next few seconds are a mess as I stay close behind Connie while she forces her way through the dozen or so men and women, dressed in everything from jeans and t-shirts to carefully styled suits for the network correspondents, and lights from three television cameras glare at us as we get to the door.
Are you the army investigators here about the murders?
No comment, I say.
Are the four rangers being defended by the army?
No comment. A younger voice screams out,
You've got blood on your hands, killers! Blood on your hands!
That doesn't deserve any kind of response, so I keep my mouth shut and we finally get into our meeting room. The room is still small, still crowded with furniture. I find the first available chair and sink heavily into it. Up on the whiteboard are the list of civilian victims and the booking photos of the four rangers. Before we start, I say, just a reminder when it comes to talking to the news media. Don't. My crew all nod, and Captain Pierce comes over with a cardboard cup of coffee, which I sip. It's cold. No surprise. Connie takes a chair, joining Special Agent Sanchez and Dr. Huang. We'll go first, I say. Connie? Connie removes a legal pad from her shoulder bag and starts off.
Major Cook and I met this morning with Major Frank Moore, the executive officer for the Rangers 4th Battalion at Hunter Army Airfield. He was stunned that these four would have been arrested for such a crime. He said Sergeant Jefferson and his fire team are known as the Ninja Squad for their ability to enter a house full of hostiles and kill them all.
Captain Pierce frowns. That's a hell of a precedent. I mean, no disrespect, Major, but if that's what they're known for in Afghanistan, it certainly complicates things. I say, it certainly does. Connie? She nods, flips a page.
After meeting with Major Moore, we had a brief session with their CO, Lieutenant Colonel Vincent Marcello. He also repeated Major Moore's point that these are highly skilled, professional, and decorated soldiers. But he would not go out of his way to praise them. He said that while on post out of a combat zone, they can be a disciplinary problem, even though no law enforcement agency has officially filed a complaint against them.
Anything more than that? Sanchez asks. Can we talk again to the colonel? I say, Marcello is currently airborne with three companies of the 4th Battalion, heading out for a deployment. The best we can do is talk to a Captain Rory O'Connell. He's the rear detachment commander, handling battalion affairs while they're deployed. But he's gearing up for ETS, so we need to get to him quick. Huang looks around, looking embarrassed, and says,
What's ETS, Major?
Expiration of term of service, I explain, meaning Captain O'Connell is a few months away from being discharged. Connie continues with another flip of a page.
The Major and I also went to the convenience store the four rangers visited prior to the killings. The worker said we need to talk to the store's owner before viewing any surveillance recordings.
When Connie pauses, I say, We also visited the coroner's office to examine the victims. In this county, the coroner is an elected position,
and he's also the local funeral director. His son was working alone tonight and refused this entry. We'll try again tomorrow. And just so all of you know, Agent York and I were followed after we left that funeral home. No big surprise, some folks around here are cautious about what we're doing. Anybody else encounter anything similar? Sanchez quietly says, A truck with its lights and engine switched off tried to scare me away while I was out working on Route 119 at the driveway to the summer house. Sped by so quick I could feel its breeze. This gets everyone's attention. I say, You all right? He shrugs. I've experienced nastier work in the Rampart Division. It's okay. I make it a point to give everyone a quick look so I know they're paying attention. All right, folks, stay alert out there, and make sure all of you have your TAC vests handy. And Pearson Wang, I know lawyers and psychiatrists don't always walk around armed, but make sure you carry your service weapons. Lieutenant Wang? My psychiatrist says,
This morning, Captain Pearson and I tried to gain access to the Ralston Town Jail. The attendant wouldn't let us in. I stayed behind while Captain Pierce went to visit the district attorney. At about 17:15 hours, I got into the jail and interviewed the four rangers.
Pierce looks impressed. Doc, when I left, you were taking it easy in the park across the street. How the hell did you get in? Dr. Huang seems pleased with himself.
Trade secret. Anyway, I got in, and I interviewed two of the rangers, Corporal Barnes and Specialist Ruiz. And they stuck to a script, mostly name and rank, and that Staff Sergeant Jefferson is the best leader they've ever served under.
Sanchez nods. Hanging together, big surprise.
Huang says, But I started off at the youngest squad member, Specialist Vinnie Tyler. The other two were calm and collected. Tyler, he was defiant, but he wanted to talk, especially about the difference between frontline troops like him and rear echelon soldiers like us. But before he left, there was guilt there. Serious guilt. I plan to go back tomorrow, see if I can take that further.
I ask, and Staff Sergeant Jefferson? Huang pauses, then says,
He was the surprise. I didn't expect him to talk to me, but he did. And he wasn't happy I was there. Threatened to hurt me if I came back and talked to the Rangers again. But he let something slip in our talk when he was getting angry with me. Major, he practically admitted he and his Rangers were there that night.
We all get quiet. Someone's pounding at the door claiming to be from the New York Times or the Washington Post. I'm not sure and I don't care. Go on, I say.
I told him that we were here to find out the truth, especially if it might be able to help him and his men,
Huang carefully says.
And he threw that right back in my face, said something to the effect that the families of those who resided in that old historical house wouldn't forget what happened that night.
Silence in our little room. Huang shakes his head.
Major, they've been there. They know what the location looks like. Sir, based on what we've learned so far, the matched empty shell casings and the fingerprints. I think they were at that house and slaughtered those civilians.
That hangs in the air for a moment, and then my cell phone rings. Anonymous caller, the screen states. Cook, I answer. The man's voice is low and to the point. Your goddamn killers butchered our neighbors. You think you're gonna help them get away with it? You're wrong. Pack up and go back to DC, assholes. I say, we're actually from Quantico. By then, the man is hung up.
Chapter 26.
I brush off the phone call. I heard much worse said to my face working Midtown South, but my doctor's considered statements have made my stomach do a slow flip. It seems the locals love us, I say. Is there anything else, Doc?
No, sir, he says. I'll report back tomorrow after I try to interview Specialist Tyler again.
More pounding on the door. This time it's CNN. Then they go away and it's quiet again. Captain Pierce, I say. Did you meet with the district attorney?
Affirmative, sir, he says. Cornelius Slate runs the county's business out of his office. Looks like the stereotypical small-town lawyer, but he's got serious legal chops. Graduated from George Mason and was a high-priced corporate lawyer for years before retiring to Sullivan. Bad news for the Rangers is that justice moves slowly in this county. It might be weeks or even months before an indictment is prepared. And in the meantime, he's told me that he's gung-ho to put all four of them on death row. Anything else? Pierce frowns.
He didn't come out and say it, but I have a sense he might be the local chapter head of the Sons of the Confederacy. And that's all I got for now.
Good to know, I say.
Agent Sanchez, you're up. Sanchez leans forward in his chair, clasps his hands together.
Sheriff Williams said there was a female witness out walking her dog who saw a pickup truck depart the crime scene the night of the murders. I tracked her down. Wendy Gabriel. She confirms what the sheriff said, recalls seeing a truck after hearing some gunshots, and spotted two men in the cab when they stopped under a utility light.
He waits, then says, but she's lying. A second ago, Huang was doodling on his pad, Connie was rearranging her bag, and Pierce was tearing apart a donut and eating it. Now they are all staring at Sanchez.
How? I ask.
I went to the road where she says she was walking her dog and saw the truck stop and then depart. I parked my rental underneath the utility light near the driveway that goes to the summer house. It's barely working. I folded my jacket, draped it over the seat of the car. Major, I couldn't see the buttons on my jacket. How could she see two men and later ID them in a photo lineup?
Connie says. Maybe their interior light was on.
Sanchez sits up, shoots back. After committing multiple homicides, you think so, Connie? You learned that chasing down speeders outside the Beltway?
Connie starts talking. I know Sanchez doesn't have much respect for her previous service in the Virginia State Police, and Pierce and Huang try to interrupt.
Sanchez raises his voice. But that's not all!
I hold up a hand.
Cool it, folks. Sanchez, what else is there?
Sanchez's voice gets louder, firmer, and I see the old LAPD cop at him come out.
The woman is a hoarder, he points out. Lives alone except for her dog. She loves her dog. Her house is a mess except for the area where the dog food, water, treats, toys, and medicine are kept. It's spotless. But she said to the sheriff and to me that she was walking her dog that night along the state road.
She wasn't.
Huang asks, how do you know?
Sanchez says, there was no leash.
There was no leash on the porch. There was no leash by the door. There was no leash by her dog's area. There's no way she was walking her dog along that state road at night without her guy on a leash. I'm telling you, she's lying about what she was doing that night.
I smile at my guy. Good catch. Tomorrow, pay her another visit. See what she has to say about that.
In the next few minutes, there's more pounding at the door from various journalists, which we all continue to ignore. Sanchez is in the corner, speaking Spanish to his wife, three time zones away. Huang and Pierce discuss the challenges of finding a way to get a pizza delivered past the reporters. Connie works on her computer, and I stare at the whiteboard. We're starting to get evidence, which is a good thing. But between the photos up there of the Rangers and the list of the dead civilians, there's still a wide, invisible gap. What's the connection? Why were the Rangers there? If Staff Sergeant Jefferson knows the layout of the property, doesn't that put them there? Especially with the forensic evidence of fingerprints and shell casings? My cell phone vibrates and I dig it out of my jacket pocket. The ID says anonymous caller once more. I answer it thinking if I'm lucky this time, I'll be told my Microsoft computer needs repairs when a woman's voice says,
Major Cook?
Here, I say. There's the sound of music and people talking in the background, and she says in a louder voice,
It's Sheriff Williams. I know it's late and all, but I was hoping we could talk.
Certainly, I say. What's going on, Sheriff?
She says, I just found out why your Rangers killed all those people.
Chapter 27. The parking lot of the Sullivan Memorial Baptist Church is nearly packed, and Special Agent Connie York wants to drop off Major Cook and Special Agent Sanchez at the entrance. But from the rear seat, her boss says,
No, we'll all go in together.
Connie finds a spot after a couple of minutes circling the parking lot, like a predator drone seeking targets of opportunity. When they get out of the battered Ford Fusion and start toward the church, Sanchez looks at the hood and shakes his head.
Great driving there, Connie, he says. I'm sure it'll buff right out.
Before Connie can shoot back a comment, Cook says, I told her to go down that road to follow the car that had been tailing us. Unless you want to try fixing it when we get back to the hotel, knock it off, Sanchez.
Inwardly, Connie smiles as Sanchez takes the hit from the major, and the three of them slowly make their way to the side entrance of the church hall. Amplified voices come from inside the building, followed by applause and cheers. Two extended black vans pull up into open handicapped spots and the doors pop open, TV camera crews and reporters sprinting out. "Incoming for the state," Sanchez says. Through a grimace, no doubt from his aching leg, Cook says, "Just ignore them." Connie gets to the church door first and opens it up, and a plump woman in a pink dress holding a clipboard and a deputy sheriff in a brown and tan uniform are standing there. The deputy sheriff, Lindsay, according to his name tag, says, "Help you folks?" From behind them, Connie hears voices say, "Hold on, just a moment, please. We have some questions." Cook says, "Major Jeremiah Cook, Army CID, with Special Agents York and Sanchez. We're here to see Sheriff Williams." The woman frowns as she looks down at the clipboard, but the young uniformed man says, "Bonnie, it's okay. The sheriff told me they were coming in." They slip inside, and Connie looks back as the TV crews and reporters try to come in. But Bonnie, raising the clipboard like a shield, holds them back, saying over and over again, "I'm sorry, you're not on the list. I'm sorry, you're not on the list." The interior of the hall is hot and crowded, with rows of folding chairs packed with people, and at the other end of the hall, flanked by U.S. and Georgia state flags, a ruddy-faced man with carefully set black hair, wearing a gray suit, white shirt, and red tie, and standing on a small stage, speaks into a wireless microphone, an arm around the shoulders of Sheriff Emma Williams. Four male deputies stand to the other side of the man speaking, all four looking embarrassed to be there.
"And I know you people well, and your brothers and sisters serving overseas for whom I pledge my undying assistance, many of whom I've met firsthand. And I thank Sheriff Williams and everyone here in Sullivan County for your continuing and deep support, which I'll take with me to the United States Senate. Thank you, and God bless."
Whoops, hollers, and applause, the flashing of cameras, and the man hands off his microphone to an aide, turns and gives the sheriff a handshake and a peck on the cheek, and then moves into the crowd. Major Cook raises his voice to Deputy Lindsay.
"Who's that?"
"Him?"
Lindsay answers.
"That there's Representative Mason Conover from Georgia's 1st District, and in less than 2 weeks he's going to be one of our new senators. Come along, folks, I know Sheriff Williams wants to see you."
The large, muscular deputy sheriff clears a path for Connie, Sanchez, and the major, and Connie has the oddest feeling she's met Lindsay before, which is impossible, but there's that little itch at the base of her skull that tells her she knows him from somewhere. Large campaign signs, including Conover's, are tacked up around the walls, naming other candidates, from potential Congress members to potential sheriffs. And there's Williams's name, and sure enough, there's Briggs, the local funeral home director, running again for county coroner. What a way to run a county, she thinks. And then she, Sanchez, and the major are ushered into a kitchen area with sinks, refrigerators, stoves, and metal countertops. Sheriff Williams is sitting on a stool near a shiny metal preparation table, and she takes off her round, dark brown uniform hat, revealing a band of sweat above her brow.
"Politics," she says. "Ain't it something?"
The three of them take stools around the preparation table as the sheriff turns to the deputy and says,
"Clark, do me a favor and ask Zell to come in here with my business case. Thanks."
After he departs, she smiles and says,
"My deputies, all good boys. So proud of them."
With just the four of them now in the kitchen, Williams says,
"Can I get you folks something cold to drink?"
Sanchez keeps his mouth shut. Connie could use something to cut the dryness in her mouth, but senses tension from her boss and waits for him to take the lead.
"No," he says, "we're fine."
Another deputy sheriff comes in, carrying a soft brown leather satchel, which he hands over to the sheriff, and damn it, Connie has the very same feeling as before. She has the oddest sense that she knows this man too, just like the other deputy, or at least has seen them before. What is going on with her? The heat? The lack of sleep? The meals that aren't anything but deep fried? The sheriff reaches into the case, slips out a manila folder, and then pulls a photo from the folder.
"This fella, he sure looks familiar now, doesn't he?"
William slides the photo across, and she and Cook give it a look.
It's a Savannah Police Department booking photo of a young man, and she instantly recognizes him.
"That's Stuart Pike," she says. "The man found in the second floor bedroom, still in bed."
"That's right," Williams says.
"He's the official renter for the summer house, and he was involved in a bit more than moving marijuana."
She taps her finger on the photo.
"Seems he was arrested last month for selling fentanyl near Savannah State University, out on bail. We here in the county didn't know about this sideline of his, because if we did, we would have gotten to him earlier."
Another photo comes out and is placed on the table next to the booking shot. This is a formal color photo of a young and, Connie notes, very attractive African-American woman wearing a light blue formal dress. Her smile is wide and confident, and her eyes seem bright with joy and intelligence. Sanchez asks, "Who is this young lady?"
"Carol Crosby,"
Williams says. "A junior at Savannah State. She's studying marine biology, did an internship last year up in Maine at the Shoals Marine Laboratory. Perfect 4.0 grade point average. A couple of weeks ago, though, poor Carol was at an off-campus party. Looks like her drink got spiked, maybe as a joke, maybe by mistake." Connie says, "An overdose, then?" Williams nods.
"Oh, yes. It was touch and go for a while, but now she's in recovery over in Hilton Head, taking some time off from school."
Cook says, "What's the connection?" Another tap of the finger.
"This girl here, Carol Crosby."
"I'm sorry, I don't understand," Cook says.
"Oh, I'm sorry," Williams says, though her voice is definitely not sympathetic. "I thought you Army investigators would have known all of this. Carol Crosby, she's the stepdaughter of Staff Sergeant Jefferson, the head of that Ranger squad. Her mama died a few years back from cancer, and Staff Sergeant Jefferson, he's been a proud single parent ever since."
Even with what's going on in the adjacent function hall, Connie feels like it's gotten awfully quiet. Williams says,
"Detective Josh Gregory over in Savannah, when he heard about the Rangers being arrested, he dug back some and came up with Mr. Pike here. You see, Pike was arrested by a drug squad headed by Josh's crew near the college campus. And a while later, some guy called up, asking for information about whether Pike was the source of the fentanyl that nearly killed young Carol Crosby. The caller said he was calling from Hunter, and the detective who answered the phone, he used to be stationed there. Well, it ended up the detective bent investigation protocol and told this caller that yes, Pike was the supplier."
Cook looks down again at the two photos. "And?"
"And the caller said, well, that man and whoever's working with him, they're gonna pay a price. And hung up. Josh did some additional digging around, couriered these photos over to me, with one other bit of information."
"What's that?" Connie asks. Sheriff Williams picks up the two photos, one of a now dead man, the other of a nearly dead woman, and puts them back into her satchel.
"That call came from Staff Sergeant Jefferson's cell phone."
The sheriff zippers the bag shut, then looks at Connie and Cook with a sad but determined look.
"That's what happened," she says. "That sergeant and those rangers, they went into that house all angry and fired up and killed every living soul there, even that little innocent baby. You know it, and I know it. And one of these days, all four are gonna get a needle in their veins. You can count on it."
Chapter 28. At nearly 2 a.m. on Monday morning, following a very busy Sunday, the woman is very pleased to be out of her uniform, in civvy clothes, her body relaxing from